The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What I think really grabbed me in this, and I hadn't thought of it before, is that they are a country, many of whose population have always wanted to be a normal and modern country. Putin, in a very cynical and actually quite successful way, is taking a part of modernity itself and weaponizing it. The two examples that, we all have been very aware of for all the last months is the technology of the digital age. And what we're seeing in this film is the weaponization of medical science.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 24th, 2017. Last week, Lawfare hosted a screening and panel discussion of the new film Icarus at the Brookings Institution. Benjamin Wittes moderated the conversation with director Brian Fogel, producer Dan Kogan, Atlantic staff writer Julia Yaffe, and Brookings president Strobe Talbot to discuss the film and its striking similarities to Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. Podcast listeners may recall we did an earlier Lawfare podcast with Fogel in August about the film. Warning, this discussion will make more sense for those who have seen the film, available on Netflix, or have listened to that earlier episode. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 255, Icarus and Russian Meddling.
And so, Brian, I just want to start with you. Bring us up to date. So the movie ends with Grigory going into federal protection. The other day, a lot of people in the audience will know this. He wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. And what do we know? What can you tell us about where he is now, how he is, what's happened to his family, and what the level of threat that he's facing today is?
Before I answer that, where the film and his journey essentially ends is in July of last year when I bring him into protective custody. And as you see, in December of last year, Richard McLaren releases his findings that implicates 1,000 athletes. And essentially, Richard McLaren doesn't even know how far back this scandal and this scheme goes. And so here we are essentially a year and half almost where Grigory has been in protective custody, and the IOC, the Olympic Commission, is yet to do anything in regard of any sort of punishment, even when faced with this staggering amount of evidence. As of right now, Russia is going to the Winter Olympics and they are hosting next year's World Cup. And they are in the process of trying to discredit Richard McLaren and his investigation to feed their own machine and their own monster. So that, I think, is very distressing in the fallout of this film. And Grigory's op-ed, which he wrote to the New York Times 2 weeks ago, essentially was a cry for help, that here's a guy who risks his life, who came forward as an extraordinary whistleblower, with a staggering amount of evidence, and yet the Olympic Commission, WADA, don't seem to really care about what is going on. And in regards to Grigory, he's essentially been living a pretty isolated life since July of last year. They've seized the assets of his family in Russia, and that is actually accelerated. They first seized his dacha, his country home. Then they seized his bank accounts. They've now went after an apartment that his daughter, that Gregory helped his daughter buy, and they are now trying to take his wife's Moscow apartment, and there is talk that I'm hearing that they're looking at potentially trying to charge his wife of crimes, I would imagine, in a game to try to get him back. And in the fallout of this New York Times op-ed, Russia has issued a global arrest warrant for Gregory, asking for his extradition. And as of today, this moment, Russia has denied any responsibility in this scandal, has outright denied that there was any state-sponsored doping, and are literally placing the entire blame of this scandal onto Gregory. So that is about as current of an update that I can give you. And we're actively trying to figure out how to continue to protect Gregory.
So, Dan, you're one of the characters in this movie that I really feel for, because you clearly took on a movie that was about one thing. It comes to be about something completely different. It's not, at the end of the day, a sports movie or even a doping movie, right? It's a movie about covert actions and international politics. And just walk us through, you know, walk us through that change. You know, the change that you see in the film is, you know, pivots kind of 45 minutes into it. But what's the change in the production of the film? I mean, you know, when did you realize that this eccentric project that you've took on of the guy sitting to your right and my left who wants to dope himself and prove that athletes are doping is actually, you're actually dealing with the FSB and something completely different?
So in the summer of 2015, Brian came to me. I run a company that finances documentary films. And Brian came to me with this idea of doping himself and using that as a way of showing that the system was a fraud. And I loved it because of the sort of playful perversity of it. And we signed on to do that movie. And within 3 months, Gregory had been outed by this German documentary and these other Russian whistleblowers. And he was calling us saying, my life is in danger. I need to come to the United States. And at that point, we were dealing with a crisis and secondarily making a film. So we continued shooting everything, and it gave us a whole nother film to make, but we were working on getting white-collar criminal lawyers for Gregory. We were hiding him simultaneously from the FSB and from the FBI. We were working on immigration lawyers and trying to figure out the best path towards long-term immigration status for him, which related to whether or not he would cooperate with the DOJ and have an S visa, or did we need to go down the route of political asylum? And so we were exploring all of these crises. We were deep into crisis management mode at the same time that we were making a film. It was an exhausting and stressful moment. I think in the scene up there where we're talking to the guy whose face is blacked out, who we were getting some legal advice from, I felt as miserable as I looked. It was stressful because we felt the weight of the responsibility of the story, and we felt the weight of the responsibility of this man's safety, which we were learning how to handle every day as we went through it.
Julia, why does Vladimir Putin care enough about Olympic medals that he's willing to use an elaborate intelligence operation over a sustained period of time up to and apparently including murder to win a little bit more? I have seen this. I believe it. I'm not doubting it. And yet it all seems over something so profoundly unimportant. And I'm interested, and it's completely inconceivable that a U.S. intelligence operation would organize around something like this. So what is it that Russia sees in its strategic interest, or that Putin sees in his strategic interest, that makes this worth this kind of operation over this long period of time?
Well, you don't see it because you're a naive American egghead, you know, and a nerd. And
truer words.
If you were a real Russian man, you would understand. So Putin is a child of the Soviet Union to the core. He is a statist, and symbols of the state and symbols of the state's strength and prestige are extremely important, not only internationally, but also domestically. And they shore up his power both at home and abroad. And this is there's an interplay there that that is very important to his staying in power. It's very important to think about where Vladimir Putin was, for example, when the Berlin Wall was collapsing. He was in East Germany in Dresden shoveling sensitive documents into a furnace. He was trying to call Moscow. The line was dead after 1991 and the great Soviet sports machine collapsed. I mean, this was the Soviet sports machine was a juggernaut. I mean, there were so many resources dedicated to it. There was so much prestige involved in it. These were the people who ran that in the Soviet Union had to be really politically vetted because they were also traveling abroad a lot. So this was a very sensitive, very important part of Soviet propaganda to the world and again at home. In the 90s, it completely collapsed. A lot of Soviet athletes found themselves outside the borders of Russia and Ukraine and Belarus without the resources, even inside Russia, to pursue their Olympic dreams and to win gold medals for the motherland. And many of them ended up in Israel and in the U.S. and Canada and Australia. It's how you get athletes like Sharapova. You know, they've scattered to the four winds. And this was one of the many ways in Putin's eyes that Russia lost prestige and lost its standing in the world. And this is just one aspect. You know, it's the nukes, it's the army, it's the economic strength, it's you know, sticking a finger in the eye of the U.S. geopolitically wherever possible. This is just one aspect of projecting Russian strength abroad. And it also matters a lot domestically. The collapse of the Soviet Union was really a powerful psychological blow to a lot of Russians. I mean, imagine you're, let's say, an American, you're from Texas, and one morning you wake up and you're just from Texas and this country that you were from no longer exists and you don't know what to think of yourself and your place in the world and your place in life. You used to be part of this great nation that projected its power all over the world, and Putin has given Russians a lot of that that they were missing, and the Olympics are part of it. And Brian, you touched on this when you were talking to the completely chagrined scientists. Did they read the New York Times article before, by the way, when you presented them with the binders?
Yes, that was right in the fallout of the New York Times. But I think all of them there were still, they had read the article, but they hadn't faced it face to face. So it was still, I think, a shock and awe.
So you mentioned Vancouver there, and I think Vancouver was key. I was living in Moscow when Vancouver happened, and just it's hard to overstate how badly the Russians performed in the Olympics. And the medal count that they lost miserably in hockey, which is a has a lot of national pride tied up into it. So, I mean, you had like taxi drivers and cashiers and regular people on the street just tearing their hair out over how terribly Russia did and how ridiculous the country looked. And I think that, and Mutko almost lost his head for that. I mean, he was almost ousted, especially when it came out that how much money he was spending on hotels for Russian officials in Vancouver, how all the resources were going to stupid non-sports related stuff. And I think that that's a very key aspect. You had this drop in performance, and you have Rachenkov saying this very classic Russian thing: the decision was made, do better. And then, you know, the troops start, and the troops start, you know, just marching in that direction.
Okay, we will return to the decision was made, do better, in a moment. Strobe, I watched this movie and I said, this is the interference in the election, right? It is an international process that you decide that you want to corrupt because you there's some piece of national greatness as well as thumb in the eye of the Americans as well as is implicated by it. So you invest a great deal of operational capability and, frankly, take a lot of risk in order to corrupt those international processes. And so my question is, am I wrong? Is there some other way to think about the relationship between the election crisis and this film and the story that it tells? Or are they just variants of a theme? The text of one is a U.S. election. The text of another is you know, doping and sports. But the operational spirit is basically the same thing.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. And having seen this terrific film now twice, it is, I think, a additional dimension. What is, I think, can be called a new Cold War. But it's a kind of a hybrid Cold War. Rodchenko at some point in there laughed and said, we Russians have to overcheat. And they're doing that in multiple ways. They are flagrantly sending their military aircraft and their navy into the sovereign waters of the Nordics and that kind of thing. They're, of course, occupying the territory of neighboring states. And what I think really grabbed me in this, and I hadn't thought of it before, is that they are a country, many of whose population have always wanted to be a normal and modern country. Putin, in a very cynical and actually quite successful way, is taking a part of modernity itself and weaponizing it. And the two examples that, we all have been very aware of for all the last months is the technology of the digital age. And what we're seeing in this film is the weaponization of medical science.
So I'm not sure whether to direct this to Brian or Dan, so I'll direct it to both. You guys were finishing this movie as that latter story was unfolding. And I want you to talk about that. That's a, you know, you have this incredible example of a, as Strobe rightly puts it, a corruption of medical science through these covert means for the purposes of that Julia describes. And you're watching, as you're finishing this thing, the sort of same methodology applied to the electoral system of the country that you guys live in. So I don't know what the question is, except, like, you know.
I think I can.
Walk us through it.
I think I have an answer for that. There's two things. Dan and I, in multiple conversations, of course, we couldn't have predicted a Trump presidency and that was going to happen. And we certainly couldn't have predicted the fallout of the election meddling. And we had these conversations because the film premiered at Sundance, which was middle of January. And we then had 4 months after Sundance to keep working on the film that Netflix allowed us because we felt that we could continue to make a better movie and craft a better movie. And we had conversations about whether or not we should pivot into the election meddling. And as you know, the declassified report that came out the first week of January, the CIA, FBI, NSA, determined that there were 7 reasons that they believed our election was hacked. And reason number 3 they listed was for what they believed, for Putin's revenge, for what he believed was America's involvement in the unveiling of the doping scandal and the release of the Panama Papers. Mm-hmm. And Dan and I had multiple conversations, which was, well, even though we certainly see all the parallels, to us it was conjecture in the way that it wasn't sticking to the facts of the film. And as a filmmaker, we were going, this is the story. And we have to follow that story. And if we all of a sudden go over to here, even if we want that in the end, that it's not truthful to the story and that it's more important that the audience and you guys make that analogy, that you guys go, wow, this is actually a window into how Russia operates.
But you're sitting here now, the film's done. In your mind, when you read the intelligence assessment, the ISC, did you read that and say, oh, of course, this is all connected? Or was this two separate things in your mind?
I read that, and when I saw that part of the analysis was that the Russians felt that the doping scandal was an American intelligence operation, I had two reactions. One was, it must be an amazing thing to live in a totalitarian society or to come and age in one, and therefore to think that anything bad that happens must be the product of government meddling. In America, shit happens, and it's not because the government wanted it or did anything. I imagine that in Russia, something of this scale happening is unthinkable without a plan. And so it was a view into their mindset. The other thing I thought, frankly, was, fuck, I hope nobody blames us for Trump. You know, I mean, we were telling a story that we had been following for 2 years, and we want to go all the way through to the end of that story. We didn't want to address explicitly what had happened in the election and the election hacking. However, my perspective is that you cannot watch this film in this context, post-election, and not think, if they were willing to go this far, as you said, to run an extensive and complicated intelligence operation purely in the world of sports to get a few extra medals, what would they be willing to do in an area that's not just soft power, but that's hard power? That's real political power. What would they be willing to do there? And I think if you frame it to yourself in that way, it answers many questions about whether or not there probably was election hacking.
Julia, you wanted to jump in?
I saw the movie in that light as well, and what you're both saying right now makes me think even more. So covering this story has been a double challenge for me because just the election meddling story. I think every American reporter has now gotten a taste of what it's like to report on Russia, where one day you think you got it, you figured it out, you have the contours of it in your hands, and then you blink and it all falls apart into sand. And here you have the Russia, and then you have Russian intelligence, American intelligence, and you have this hall of smoke and mirrors. And I've been very skeptical of it, but also seeing this film, I was like, oh my God, the meddling. But the thing is that you don't expect them to tamper with the bottles. You don't, you know, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the details of it, right? It's only in retrospect that you're like, of course they did this and this and this, and that led to that and that and that. And we could still be guessing about what happened in the Olympics and with the doping of Russian athletes if Rodchenkov hadn't come forward and given you guys and the New York Times the blueprint and walked you through how he did. So you have the whistleblower that was the perpetrator. And so far we don't have anything like that in this case. And we have a few disparate pieces of the puzzle of how the election meddling happened, but we don't have a Sherpa of the kind that Rodchenkov was. And we're starting to get a little bit more on this as the media especially pulls back its focus from Trump and just getting Trump out of office next week, and is starting to look at the broader picture of Facebook ads, Twitter handles, troll factories, and how and actually the Russian side of this of this effort. And we did have actually one troll come forward last week, speaking to the last independent Russian TV channel, Dost, and outlining how he did his work in the troll factory. So you're going to need, I think, to really get the full picture, you're going to need a kind of a perpetrator as whistleblower to guide us.
Right. So that raises a really interesting question I'd love, Strobe, your thoughts on. You know, one thing that the doping area has that I'm not sure the election interference arena has is a WADA lab with a director, right? That there's some choke point that all the information, all the urine tests and the blood tests go through this single location that has to be run, that has to be then corrupted and that can be corrupted because you have a Rodchenkov who can then defect. Is there a WADA lab? Is there a Rodchenkov figure in this? You know, I don't know the person's name. If we're in the stage of that, the stage when the German newspaper or television station blew Rodchenkov's name, we kind of have this idea that there was Russian interference. It doesn't have a name associated with it. Is there a Grigory Rodchenkov here, or is there just some kind of nameless, faceless entities?
Well, I would defer to Julia on that, and if she has a different answer, I agree with her. But I think there probably is, perhaps not a Rodchenkov figure. Boy, would we like to hear him or her. But Putin has come very close to saying in his smug way, pretending that, yeah, no, the Russian government has nothing to do with this. The Kremlin has nothing to do with this. But we have a lot of really smart people who can do
it. Patriotic hackers who just get up in the morning and are moved by the spirit to hack.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah. There is another difference. And after I make the point, I'd like to put a question to Brian about Rodchenko himself. You used a couple of times, Ben, the word covert. Well, neither of these operations are at all covert now. And they are, you know, people are making movies about them. And so that's a similarity. The difference, though, and boy, is it is so dispiriting at the end of the movie to see that the IOC is going to barely, slap them on the wrist. But in the hacking of our democratic process in this country, Putin, as an old KGB guy, can say this was maybe one of the most spectacular and successful operations that our beloved organization has ever pulled off since Dzerzhinsky. But it didn't have the resultat that he wanted. Mm-hmm. He thought that he was going to be able to, he thought it was a small percentage that he might be able to put a friend of his in the White House. Well, he has somebody who would like to be a friend of his. But in fact, the U.S.-Russian relationship is worse than it was in the Obama administration. And it's probably going to stay that way because, among other things, most of the Republican establishment is not about to get friendly with Russia under these circumstances. But could I, Brian, ask you one question? He's a fabulous guy, and I can see why you have not only respect for him, but it was great fun in the first part. And, you know, anybody who likes dogs as much as that has got to be a pretty good human being. But what was his motive? What was he up to? What did he think his own resultat was going to be? Mm-hmm. When all of a sudden the ceiling fell in on him.
Well, before I answer that, I just wanted to back up to one thing that you said in Russia and how they would do this elaborate thing all to win a couple more medals. And in response to that, I view it so much bigger than that, because when you look at what the Olympic Games are, it is the only time where all of planet Earth comes together under this idea of unity and harmony, but what is behind that is massive geopolitics. And you look at the machinery that has to go into planning an Olympics. And let's look at Beijing in 2008 with the Chinese, right? That was China's coming out party to the world. That was China showing the world they are a first world power. They're not just a nuclear power, but they can pull off an Olympics. And you look at what they did in Beijing and the orchestration of that opening ceremonies, that closing ceremonies. I mean, it was showing the world that they are a force to be reckoned with. And according to Gregory, he got the idea to swap the urine from the Chinese in Beijing. And they did the same thing, except they didn't open up the bottles. The Chinese athletes were reporting to the drug testers, and the drug testers were handing them clean urine, and they were pretending to pee, except it was in a tube under their armpit. And Gregory got to see this. So what was that for China? China wanted to win those Olympic Games to show the world that they were strong. And Putin at Sochi, it was the identical thing. It wasn't about a couple medals. It was about showing the world that if he was going to spend $50 billion, it was pulling off this huge orchestra. And part of that orchestra was to win. You couldn't put together this whole incredible machinery and spend $50 billion to turn a subtropical climate into winter, because Sochi doesn't even really have snow. They had never skied at Sochi before the Olympics. And so to do this and then not win would be a smashing defeat for Russia. But to me, it was Russia coming out and showing the world what they were capable of doing, just like China did in Beijing, just like all of these Olympic Games are. To answer your question about Gregory, I think it's a very complicated question because his mindset, on one hand, you see him as this almost childlike character where you go, wait, what are you doing? I mean that scene where he's in my at my kitchen table smuggling my urine back to Moscow. You're going, oh, my God. Under no circumstances should you be doing this, period. I mean, amateur, no af, amateur. I mean, and everything was being captured on camera. So as I'm capturing on camera, literally he would go like this. Okay, this part isn't for the camera. It's like, but the camera's wrong. He's like, okay, don't worry about this. We'll worry about that later. So there's a part of him that almost seems like totally unaware of his own, doings. And at the same time, He is a genius. And I think that his working with me to begin with was truly based on trust, but it was also based on his playful nature. And in his mind, he had rationalized it that he really wasn't breaking laws because I'm an amateur athlete, I'm American, this isn't in the lab in Russia, this is all just fun and games. And there was also a part of him in that first year and a half, 2 years of working together, that he had a kind of an up yours to WADA, and not in a spiteful way, but in a way of these idiots, they can't catch anyone. This is a completely bogus operation. The Olympics were in on it, WADA's in on it, and there was a pleasure that he was getting out of showing just what a fraud this system is.
When did he become an actual whistleblower?
Yeah.
I mean, so like there's by the end of the movie, he's gone through this whole reading Orwell process, right? He's a sort of true believer by the end in your portrayal. When does that change?
This is another way of asking a version of Strobe's question, which is, why did he do this? There are actually two whys. There's the why did he start talking to Brian to begin with? And then there's, once he was outed by the German documentary, why did he decide to come to the U.S. and tell everything? He could have stayed in Russia.
The camera rolling.
He felt he was not safe in Russia. So he left. He came to us. But he could have come to America and made clear to his bosses in Russia that he was here and he was going to stay, but he was not going to talk. That's the moment that he became a whistleblower. So there are really two whys. There's, why was he participating with Brian in the first spot? And then when he got in trouble, why did he decide to go all the way? Why did he decide to become a whistleblower?
If he'd gone the whole way, he should have brought his family.
Yeah. They didn't want to come. He tried to bring them, but they didn't want to come.
I think the other lesson is, I'll probably get the timeline wrong, but every Russian, especially the higher up you get, and the more dangerous it gets, that because the stakes are higher and you're exposed to more information, more kompromat on everybody. Everybody has a very strong self-preservation instinct, which is weird to me that he didn't. I mean, Russians around cameras are.
He has a self-destruction instinct.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the cameras are like vampires, and they'll suck out their souls.
Yes.
But I think he was absolutely right to talk openly and to speak to the New York Times. Actually, one of my best friends is Mike Schwartz, who's one of the journalists who interviewed him, a former Moscow correspondent, because up the street is the DuPont Circle Hotel, where Mikhail Lesin, the former information minister, founder of Russia Today, died of natural causes after suffering blunt force trauma to the head, neck, trunk, arms, and legs.
Yeah, he beat the shit out of himself.
Yeah, he fell down a ladder 50 times, you know, and because then it came out that the room was paid for by the feds, and he had an appointment at the DOJ the next day. So the lesson is talk quickly and talk publicly to protect yourself.
And what Gregory, you know, in multiple conversations that I had with him, he, to this day, believes that every single day of his life since he got out of Russia and essentially escaped, because the only reason why he was able to get out is he had a U.S. visa to come here and lecture, because he was lecturing at anti-doping symposiums. And he gets out 6 days after the release of the first investigation, and so Russia was kind of blindsided. He was still going to the lab every day and cleaning up his mess. He had been working with him for all these years. They weren't like thinking, oh, he's going to flee. And it happened so fast. They probably didn't realize he had a visa to come to the U.S. And it was like that. But he said to me that every single day that he got to Los Angeles, that he viewed it was an extra day that he was alive, that he viewed himself as dead. And to this day, every day that he lives is another day that he should be dead. So in his mind, he was a dead man walking. There was no way that he was going to live. Even if he kept his mouth shut in Russia, he was going to be gone.
Or even if he kept his mouth shut here.
Even kept his mouth shut here once they knew he was here and what that information he had. So I think he just said, "Hey, this is my only chance at survival." And on top of that, there were a lot of other, and I wouldn't call it revenge reasons, but he was very upset at the ministry, because what had happened is he had went from essentially being a scientist. And we don't get into this in the film, but he develops a test called the long-term metabolite test. And this test is put into action, essentially, right in time for the Beijing Olympics. And this test allowed the detection for steroids to go from about 3 weeks to about 7 months. Now, at the same time that he develops this test, it becomes the worldwide standard to catch all the athletes around the world using steroids if they'd been using them within 3 weeks. He develops the anti-venom to his own test, which is the three-drug cocktail that he's feeding steroids to the Russian athletes by diluting them in Chivas for the men, because men like whiskey, and martini for the women. And this is true. And he had realized that if you gave the steroids and used alcohol, that the steroids didn't get absorbed into the blood, and that all the Russian athletes were able to evade the test that he had created. So he was the venom and the anti-venom. He was literally on both sides of this. And that for him was science. And what changed with Sochi was he went from being a scientist to essentially being, as he says, their doggy bag. That he was there now just to dump out dirty piss, swap in clean piss. This was not about science anymore. This was just a fraud. And for him, there was a huge drawing the line, because his job was now just a job of of fraud, and it wasn't about the science any longer. And he took offense to that.
It's funny because it's not like the first one sounds so honorable.
But it's so Russian. I mean, this whole film, I know you set out to make a film about cycling and doping and WADA, and the, but to me, it's a film about Russia. It's like, and Grigory is just the most Russian man. I mean, the way he talks, the way he moves, the way he that he lives with these contradictions in himself. It's just, all of it is so quintessentially Russian.
So I want to ask Strobe and Julia one more question before we go to the audience, and that is, what should we assume here about Putin's individual involvement in any of this? In the case of the election meddling, the intelligence community assessment said it was approved in Russia at the highest levels of government, which one can only assume means Putin himself. What should we assume that Putin knows or ordered the deaths of the people who were killed? Should we assume that he knows how urine samples are being swapped? What should we assume about his level of engagement with any of this?
Maybe I could start and leave Julia to answer the really hard question, which is whether he's actually fingering those who are going to be assassinated. It's important to remember that Putin is the most powerful Kremlin leader since Stalin. And that might sound strange because Russia is not like Russians, Stalinist Russia. But Stalin was a tyrant and a dictator, and he had no board of directors to, that he had to mollify and stay more or less in step with them. Everybody after that, up to Gorbachev, and that didn't turn out so well for him, and Yeltsin was, of course, damaged goods pretty soon after he moved into the Kremlin. Whereas Putin believes in what he calls the vertical of power. And I don't think anything remotely as important and as dangerous and perhaps successful as the two operations we're talking about, the digital weaponization and the medical weaponization, he would have had his authority at the beginning, in the middle, and the end.
I agree with that. I think the comparison to Stalin is really apt, and you have to understand that both Stalin and Putin derive their power basically from two podes. One is bureaucracy and just bureaucratic jujitsu and how good both of them were at bureaucracy and maneuvering within it and manipulating the Russian cultural affinity for bureaucracy, and the other is just the monopoly on brute force and the fact that both under Stalin and under Putin, the security services and the siloviki, the strongmen, have come to dominate pretty much everything, including the economy. So, as have the bureaucrats. I thought what Rodchenkov laid out that was equally important as the kind of the detailed mechanics, the TikTok of how the bottles were swapped and how they were opened, et cetera, was the chain of command. And of course, he knew he was next because the guy right above him was taken out, right? And then you have Nagornikh, this guy with this classic KGB face. There's many words for it in Russian, and face is not the one I would use. Anyway, and then you have Mutko, who is kind of an idiot functionary, and then you have Putin. And to illustrate how these things are generally done and how power is delegated and how missions are set, I just want to tell you an anecdote from just a personal story. So after my family left, many of our friends, many of my parents' friends stayed in Russia and were there during the capitalistic transition. And many of them went into, most of them went into business, as everybody did in the 90s, to enrich themselves. One friend went to work for probably the biggest banker in Russia. And sitting in on the board meetings, the 90s were a pretty bloody time if you were in capitalism. You know, it was like the Sopranos do capitalism. And the banker, the guy, the CEO, wasn't saying, you know, this guy's a problem, take him out, or we need to necessarily acquire, you know, the following tiny banks. It was just like, listen, we need to achieve this resultat. We're rowing in this direction. Go. And if people turned up dead as they're, you know, macheting their way through that forest, he didn't necessarily order it. He didn't necessarily know about it. And that's by design. It's to build plausible deniability into the system. So Putin probably didn't know about how the bottles were open or even that there were bottles being opened. He might not, on purpose, not know the very, very, and Mutko might not know the very details, so that when he goes on a talk show, he's not really lying. He's not technically lying, right? In Russia, it's all about being right on the technicality, so like respecting the letter of the law while raping the spirit of the law. And I think both with the hacking and this, and Grigory said it, he said it was a top-level decision by you know who I mean, get the best result. And that's generally how it works. Putin sends a signal, and it trickles down the bureaucracy. And at each level, you have people who are trying to please their immediate, both to please their immediate superior and to not get in trouble. And I think Nagornyi, with his FSB past and that face, you can see that he was the muscle behind. Correct me if I'm wrong. He seemed like the muscle and the kind of the brass knuckles behind
Gregory
the operation.
Yeah, always said that Nagornov, he could kill anybody.
He looks like that.
Nagornov,
those guys all look like that.
Yeah. And Gregory was the most in fear of Nagornov. There's one interesting point when you talk about Putin's involvement, and we leave this out of the film, but right after Sochi, Gregory was awarded the Medal of Friendship by Putin.
Please join me in thanking Dan and Brian and my two co-panelists who have vacated the stage.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.